All right, today we're going to be talking about another of the inotropic ligand-gated receptors, the nicotinic receptors. These are receptors for acetylcholine, so they're considered to be cholinergic receptors. And we're going to be talking about the specific type that is gated by nicotinic ligands. There is an entirely separate class of acetylcholine receptors. Anybody know the name of those? We've mentioned them previously. Muscarinic receptors, okay, that have effects indirectly on one of the important types of potassium channels we talked about earlier. So you should keep in mind some of the muscarinic drugs that we've mentioned earlier, but they're not going to apply, with the exception of acetylcholine, to nicotinic receptors. All right. Nicotinic receptors are pentameric receptors. Pentameric. So how many subunits does that mean?
Five.
A typical nicotinic receptor will have two alpha subunits. Two alphas. We'll see a good example of a violation of that rule in just a moment. And then they will have any number of other types of subunits, betas, gammas, deltas, epsilons. There's a variety of other subunit types. But your typical nicotinic receptor will have two alpha subunits. They will typically have a Hill coefficient of 2. So how many molecules of acetylcholine then would bind to them? How many would be required to activate the receptor?
Two.
Okay. And your typical pentameric nicotinic receptor is a ligand-gated sodium channel. The ion selectivity for the channel is for sodium ions. Sodium, a cation, an anion? Cation, what's the valence on it? Plus one. Is concentration higher outside the neuron or inside?
Outside.
So which way would it run down its concentration gradient? Generating an inward current, what would that do to membrane potential? It would generate a depolarization. Very good. We talked about various types of gating mechanisms a couple weeks ago. For nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, the gating mechanism appears to be a general conformational change. Rotation of all the subunits opening up that central ion channel. Closed configuration, they're all in one conformation. Open configuration, they rotate to open the throat of that channel up. Nice and uniform, consistent. Pretty straightforward. Again, how many subunits?
Five.
That pentameric structure has some importance to it. All right. It turns out that nicotinic receptors in the history of the neurosciences are very important. They were the first type of neurotransmitter receptor that were purified, where we can actually identify that this is the receptor protein. Once that was known, then it was the first of the receptors to be sequenced, where we actually knew the protein structure. What amino acids made up that protein? How were they aligned with one another? How many subunits? All that sort of information. Then they were the first of the receptors to be cloned, where once we took that available information, we could reproduce quantities of nicotinic receptors. We can insert them into new cell types, put them into artificial membrane systems. We could do lots of experiments with them. And then they were also imaged and various other techniques applied as well. The reason why they were the first is entirely an accident of nature. It has to do with this particular type of fish called a torpedo fish. sometimes also called an electric ray. Okay? These fish have extremely large numbers of nicotinic receptors in the front end of their body in what's called their electroplax organ. The reason they have them is because literally they shock their prey by using this organ. They have kilogram quantities of these receptors. How many, what kind of quantity do you think you have of nicotinic receptors in your brain? Not grams, way, way below grams. Doubt even a microgram. Down in the nanogram amounts. These have kilogram quantities. 10 to the 12th times as much as you have in your brain. That made the biochemistry rudimentarily simple compared to trying to work on a nervous system like we have in our head. This is actually a specialized form of a neuromuscular junction, but it's not to activate a muscle. It's just to have lots of these receptors available. So when you activate them, you get lots of sodium channels suddenly opened at the same time. And what flows through sodium channels? Sodium ions. And what do they do to cell membranes? Depolarize them. Cell by cell, they might depolarize them by 100 millivolts. Hundreds of thousands of cells at the same time, maybe a million cells at the same time, with several tens of thousands of receptors on each of those cells, hundreds of volts of electricity that then propagates through the nice aquatic medium around them, salt water, and stuns any fish that happen to be in their vicinity. It also stuns the electric fish. But guess what? They're used to it. It's happened lots of times to them. They realize when they wake up it's time to eat. Their prey don't have any idea what's going on. And then it's too late because then they're eaten. Very effective mechanism. So they've adapted this over millennia to feed themselves. As a consequence, we had huge amounts of this receptor protein to deal with. And a group in France, headed by a guy by the name of Chan Zhou, spent decades working on this large quantity of protein to figure out exactly how it functioned, how it was shaped. So when you image it from above, you can actually see the five subunits around the central pore or channel of the protein. When you look at it from the side, you can see it inserted within the membrane, with the extracellular portion and the intracellular portion. You can pull the protein apart and sequence each of the different subunits that make up that protein. And then you can put it back together and see if you've got a functional receptor. So by having these large quantities, it simplified the task tremendously. It took them up until the mid-1970s, even early 1980s to finish the task, even with those kinds of quantities. And it took another 10 or 15 years after that before we got to the next receptor protein, that level of analysis. Because we don't have those kinds of quantities of any others. We had to come up with better techniques in the meantime to be able to reach that same stage for other types of receptors. But this gave us the general principles that then worked for other types of proteins in the nervous system. And without this, we probably still wouldn't know it. That'd probably be good for you as a student right now. You'd have lots less to learn. Sorry about that. You can thank the electroplax organ of the torpedo fish for making your life as a student harder right now. One thing we've learned since the initial studies is that pentameric receptors are very similar to one another. So today we're focusing on the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, and specifically the portion of it that's highly conserved is the alpha subunits. How many did a typical nicotinic receptor have? Two of those. Turns out they're very similar in structure to receptors we're going to talk about on Thursday. The subunits that make up GABA receptors. Subunits that make up glycine receptors. Now, obviously, those are very similar receptors to one another, right? Nicotinic, are those excitatory receptors or inhibitory? Excitatory. How about GABA and glycine receptors? Inhibitory. So pentameric doesn't tell you which type it is, but they all have seem to have some common ancestral origin. And then there's been a shift in function somewhere along the line. Very slight mutation in the structure that resulted in this change in function. Okay, if we look through the central nervous system, this is the nervous system of a rat here, we see that the messenger RNAs that are used to produce the proteins are differentially distributed. There's regional variation in where these proteins can be produced in the nervous system. Different types of alpha subunits, some are pretty much all over at moderate levels. Some are at high levels in certain areas and low levels elsewhere. Some are extremely high levels in some areas and absent in other areas. Same for some of the other subunits, the betas. In fact, this one is only found in this one structure. You may know what this structure is. It's labeled H. You know what H? The what? Those are all good guesses. I'll give you a hint. It starts with H, and it's not hippocampus. It's not hypothalamus.
Habenula.
This is one of the major sources of acetylcholine in the nervous system. How many of you studied that extensively in neuroanatomy? No? Anybody taken any of Dr. Kilgard's classes about cholinergic modulation of cortex? Anybody? Nobody? Didn't get mentioned there either, unfortunately. So you hadn't heard of the habenula. Maybe there will be a nice bonus point. Can tell me something about the habenula. If you notice, it's showing up on every one of these. Every type of nicotinic receptor, and in fact, there's lots of acetylcholine produced there as well. You may know the structure it's right next to. So it's right in the middle of the brain. Something that in ancient literatures used to be called the third eye, the pineal gland. Okay, it sits on either side of the pineal gland. Anybody know what's produced in the pineal?
Melatonin.
Turns out the habenula is important in things like our circadian rhythms, whether you are sleepy or not, things of that sort. You haven't heard much about it previously. We need to remedy that. Okay. If nothing else, you've heard about it now. Anybody not heard the word habenula? Okay. All right. Nicotinic receptors are developmentally regulated. At different stages in your life, your nicotinic receptors look different. Their subunit composition is different. Again, a typical one will have two alpha subunits. Very often they'll have a beta subunit and a delta subunit. But early in development, they will typically also have a gamma subunit. And yet, after you're born, your nicotinic receptors will shift. Instead of having that gamma subunit, they'll instead express an epsilon subunit. So physiologically, they have some differences at different stages in the lifespan. It looks like there's some additional changes that go on later in life as well. And there's a pretty extensive literature on developmental changes of these. Another important thing that we need to talk about is where they're located. Nicotinic receptors are very commonly found not just postsynaptically, but also presynaptically. They can be found on the same axons that release acetylcholine. Anybody from your readings know the term that we would use for those? Pardon? Say it louder. Feedback inhibition. Okay, that's the mechanism used. But we have a specific name we use for those kinds of receptors. We call them autoreceptors. If they're found on the terminal that releases that transmitter, they're receiving the message they just released. Autoreceptors. It doesn't mean they have anything to do with a car. You don't have to add gasoline or oil or anything. Autoreceptor means that they influence the release of that specific neurotransmitter. Postsynaptically, they're just called postsynaptic receptors. What if they're on an axon terminal that doesn't release acetylcholine? What would we call them? We would just call them presynaptic receptors. If the neuron releasing acetylcholine forms an actual synapse with another axon, then we call that an axo-axonal synapse. But acetylcholine could just drift away from a synapse and have effects at a distance on presynaptic receptors as well. There's not always a clear synapse involved. So what would happen if these are sodium channels? What would that do if they're activated through a presynaptic terminal? Hyperpolarize it? Depolarize it?
Depolarize
it. What happens when you depolarize an axon terminal? You get activation of voltage-gated calcium channels. If that happens the same time that an action potential comes down, you might release more vesicles of neurotransmitter. So you could facilitate release of other neurotransmitters with these presynaptic nicotinic receptors. That's one potential effect. Unfortunately, we've learned that there are more complex effects that could occur. And that's due to a specific, specialized form of nicotinic receptors that we these days call alpha-7 receptors. Alpha-7 receptors. These receptors are weird and different from all the other nicotinic receptors in that they are monomers. They're still pentameric, but all of the subunits are identical to one another. Instead of having two alpha subunits, they have five of them. All of them alpha sevens. Five alpha seven subunits. These are very commonly found on presynaptic terminals. And the oddity, since they're all the same subunit, they're no longer sodium channels. They function as calcium channels, all right? Rather than indirectly influencing calcium presynaptically, these would directly impact calcium presynaptically. So again, what would that do to neurotransmitter release? Increase it. Then it doesn't even have to be timed with the action potential. You'll have more calcium present when the action potential comes down and activates more calcium channels. So again, they facilitate neurotransmitter release. They cause more release. These are believed by the best of our available research to be the reason why nicotine is such an addictive drug. I'm not going to ask if anyone here smokes. But if we look at the number of alpha-7 receptors present in a non-smoker's brain, do you know what kind of imagery we'd have to use for that? Probably SPECT. You'd have to put a radio-labeled ligand in that binds to those alpha-7 receptors. Compare that. Very low levels of the receptors in a non-smoker's brain. Look at the smoker's brain. Very high levels of those receptors. The more you smoke, the more of those receptors you produce. The addicted nicotine user's brain has a change in its protein expression that seeks out these higher calcium levels. And that has other effects. Instead of looking at receptors, let's look at glucose utilization in a smoker's brain. When they haven't had a cigarette for an hour, glucose utilization is very high. An hour is a reasonably long time for a tobacco user to go without smoking. How long are our classes here at UTD?
An hour
and 15 minutes. Sometimes you can predict whether somebody's a smoker to see how quickly they leave class after a particularly long lecture. Could be just that they have another class right afterwards. Or maybe they didn't make it to the restroom in time before class. But it might be that they're running so they can get more than 100 feet away from a building so they can smoke. You take that person that had extremely high glucose utilization because they've been deprived of nicotine. Now you give them one puff off of a cigarette. Their brain glucose utilization goes down. Three puffs goes way down. An entire cigarette, way down. Let them smoke as much as they'd like. Three cigarettes in that case, still further down. It actually seems to relax the brain. Less glucose utilization, which usually correlates very strongly with less activity.
So how does the brain look in the individual
who doesn't smoke? Well, their glucose utilization typically looks more like so. Not as relaxed as a smoker after a large number of cigarettes. But during very active periods, it will ramp up as well. They're not doing anything but just sitting waiting for a cigarette. There's no mental task going on.
And what about those people who smoke for years and they quit completely? Is that the same thing?
These changes take weeks to months to go away. These changes seem to take longer to change. So in fact, if they're re-exposed, say they walk into a room where people are smoking, their glucose utilization goes way up. And we translate that into their craving goes up, even if they don't smoke. And in fact, typically, if they're trying to remain abstinent, not using the drug, they don't get that relaxation. And that's part of, again, what makes it so difficult for many people to quit. And why, in fact, something like a tobacco, a nicotine patch or nicotine gum that steps the dose down slowly may actually be easier for some people.
So the glucose utilization, the lower the glucose utilization, the more relaxed you are.
Well, the less activity related just to the drug-seeking behavior. Because this all has to do with wanting that nicotine. And they're not handed the cigarette, until it's determined they're going to be in this group. Some people just have to sit there. They even did it, in fact, with people watching someone else smoke. That made this light up even higher glucose utilization. That's kind of a mean experiment to do, though. Nicotine is well known among pharmacologists as one of the most addictive drugs that we know of. Very tightly regulated drug, right?
No.
Pretty much everyone in this room has very ready access to it if you're willing to pay the state tax on tobacco. State of Texas doesn't believe in taxes, right? So cigarettes must be about 20 cents a pack.
$7.
$7? Okay. How old are you supposed to be to buy cigarettes?
18.
Okay. Don't think that's well enforced either.
Okay, so when the person is craving the cigarettes and there's an increase in glucose, what does that do systemically to the body? Like, the fact that the brain has these high levels of...
Typically, then, it drives all sorts of systems. So if you look at heart rate, sweating, all sorts of other things, those indices are up as well. And when they smoke the cigarette, even though the nicotine has direct effects on the heart to drive heart rate up, the nervous system effect helps drive that back down. So you'd have more cardiac effects if it wasn't something the brain was being satisfied by as well. It's a very complex system. All right, again, those are not your typical nicotinic receptors. Those were the alpha 7 receptors. Your typical nicotinic receptors gate sodium currents. This is the nicotinic molecule and its source. Again, what was the Hill coefficient?
So
take two molecules of acetylcholine to end up with an activated acetylcholine receptor. Typical distribution of charge flow through an ion channel associated with that nicotinic receptor is very stable. How about IV curves? Have we ever talked about IV curves before? Everybody should be very familiar with IV curves at this point in time, right? Hint, hint, hint. We're only a week away from our next exam. Again, what's on this particular axis? Voltage from very hyperpolarized to very depolarized. What's on the y-axis? Current. Should be labeled in some way, right? Okay. Downward means inward or outward current?
Inward.
One person says it wrong and everybody goes along, huh? Downward is an inward current. Upward is an outward current. Okay, at the range of membrane potentials that neurons typically exhibit, what kind of current through these channels? Inward or outward current? An inward current. So as soon as the nicotine is applied around the resting potential of the membrane, will we get a strong current or a weak current? Very strong inward current. Read the axis. Is this down the axis? Is this a big current? Up here is a small current, right? So at the resting potential of a neuron, if you apply nicotine and it's got nicotinic receptors, you're going to get a lot of depolarization really quickly. Very strong physiological effect on a neuron. And data like that, again, comes from these sorts of experiments where you apply the ligand at different membrane potentials. Have we talked about the phenomenon of desensitization before? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. What was it analogous to if we were talking about a voltage-gated channel instead of a ligand-gated one? Very similar to the process of inactivation. In the case of nicotinic receptors, we have a new mechanism, and that is that phosphorylation of the receptor desensitizes it to the presence of acetylcholine. We know of any cascades that could cause phosphorylation?
Yes.
Okay. Things linked through PKA or PKC or CAM kinase, or even through the growth factors that we just very briefly mentioned. Are there other kinases in neurons as well? Hundreds of others that we're not going to cover in this sort of introductory version of neuropharmacology. So phosphorylation desensitizes these receptors to the presence of the ligand that gates them. So therefore, you can keep applying acetylcholine and you're not going to get the current flow that you had initially. So what would you do to resensitize them? Dephosphorylate them. Do we know of any mechanism to remove phosphate groups from proteins? Phosphatases. Do we know of any phosphatases? Okay. So everything you learned for the first exam, gee, you might still need to know that stuff. So are there any uses for nicotinic ligands besides smoking? Probably. I think definitively there are. Okay. Turns out that you can use them for treatment of motor dysfunctions. Where would we have nicotinic receptors in the nervous system? We have them in the brain? We already saw pictures of them labeled in the brain. How about at the autonomic nervous system? Are there any cholinergic receptors there? Yep. At the ganglionic synapse between the premotor neuron and the motor neuron in the autonomic nervous system. We'll look at that in a little more detail in a minute. Are there any nicotinic receptors anywhere else? I think somebody named it before. The neuromuscular junction. What's the neuromuscular junction? It's the synapses between nerves and muscles. That's not a trick question. The motor neurons form neuromuscular synapses. Okay. Turns out that nicotinic ligands may have some important uses in treatment of cognitive issues. For instance, we've known anecdotally for a number of years that heavy smokers don't tend to develop Alzheimer's as frequently as non-smokers. That's not an advertisement to go out and start smoking. There's a problem with that. Alzheimer's is increasing as you get older. Heavy smokers tend to die off of other diseases before they hit that older age range. Even when you count out those other cardiovascular risk factors, though, Alzheimer's is still rarer among the surviving smokers. Maybe their brains are just tougher from all the other abuse that it has gone through. Or maybe there is some beneficial effect to those doses of nicotine in the central nervous system. It's interesting that you have put yourself into a group by your own choice that tends to have a lower incidence of Alzheimer's, and that is college-educated individuals. By going to college, you've decreased your risk of developing Alzheimer's, or at least put it off a few years. Don't say yay yet, because unfortunately, that means that if you do develop Alzheimer's, the statistics also tell us that you're going to decline much more rapidly.
I'll see you
Again, we don't know the causative factor. Maybe it's because you're used to being so brilliant now that the differential with Alzheimer's is just more than you can survive. Or perhaps you've been pushing your brain harder now. So now when it kicks into that mode where degeneration is going on, it does that harder and better too. We don't know at this point in time. Somebody out here needs to figure that out. It turns out not just in special things like Alzheimer's, but just in general memory utilization. Nicotinic drugs tend to have what we call nootropic effects. They improve learning and memory. Again, I'm not advertising that you go smoke a pack of cigarettes when you're studying, because unfortunately psychology has also pointed out a very good truism here. It's called state-dependent learning. You have to be in the same state then when you take the exam. And you're in the wrong state for that. Texas has banned smoking in classrooms. I don't think the accessibility center on campus will allow smoking either. You probably can't get your prescription for medical marijuana and then use it to take the exam either, though. Nicotinic drugs are used to regulate autonomic nervous system functions. If you have some heart problems, there are certain things that might be done with nicotinic drugs. Very common application is for surgical practice. How many of you like to be a surgeon and have your patient, when you cut into them, sit up and slug you in the face? That would be a very common reaction for somebody if you were stabbing them. Well, you're doing much more damage very often than you would stabbing them in surgery. So you might like them not even to have any reflexive response to that pain, much less a conscious response. And then, of course, there are lots of non-clinical, non-approved uses. All the different types of tobacco products, which the state in its wisdom derives lots of tax money for. In fact, it probably pays part of the bill for the lights in this room right now. Many insecticides actually act on nicotinic receptors. The ones that we've had available the longest, and they're still the most widely used, impact these receptors. And in fact, there's a long history of humans using nicotinic antagonists, particularly for the same sorts of applications that the torpedo fish did. Of course, we can't generate lots of voltage, so we just block the receptors in things that we shoot these compounds into, with blowguns or rubbing it on the tips of arrows. Wouldn't much matter to coat a bullet with it. I think the bullet would do it all by itself. Okay. So wide range of different uses for things that interact with nicotinic receptors. Now, I decided for this exam, you've got a lot of material piled on you, so I'm not going to go over the synthesis or metabolism of acetylcholine. I'll save that for after this exam when we talk about muscarinic receptors. But I did want to point out something related to that. We're talking about a class of receptors for acetylcholine, ACH. If you look at the experimental literature in the neurosciences, you'll very rarely see ACH used as the ligand for activating these receptors, because it has a particular problem. There's enzymes all around cholinergic synapses that immediately degrade acetylcholine, break it down. Anybody know what those enzymes are called? Cholinesterases. And we'll talk about cholinesterases a lot after this exam. Well, thankfully, chemists have come up with a solution for that problem. Analogs of acetylcholine that are not acted upon by those cholinesterases. So they're not broken down. So it makes it easy to measure responses generated by acetylcholine or responses generated by nicotinic receptors. And the one of the list that I would suggest you learn, because it's used about 95% of the time, is the compound carbachol. Carbachol. If you look at its molecular structure, it's almost identical to acetylcholine. The only difference is this extra nitrogen in here. Works just the same at the receptor, but it's not broken down by the enzyme that degrades this transmitter. And there are lots of other analogs available, but this one was the first one developed, and it's the most widely used still. Okay, that's the easy part for today. Now let's get into drugs. Don't start taking drugs, but start taking notes about drugs. Let's look first at agonists for nicotinic receptors. Looks overwhelming, but let's break it down piece by piece. All right, first of all, what's the year? 2011. Okay, you picked the wrong year to study pharmacology. It's gotten more complex over the last few years. If you'd only chosen to be born a decade earlier, it would have been a lot easier. Right now, we know of four major types of nicotinic receptors. Before you beat yourself up about when you were born, it's not as bad as it's going to be in the next couple of years. Because now when we start looking at the different types of subunits that make up the receptors, that I'm not going to ask you to pay attention to yet, another 4 or 5 years, this chart's probably going to have about 15 different varieties on it. So you didn't pick the best time to be born, but you didn't pick the worst time to be born either. However, show of hands, who plans to go to medical school or graduate school or dental school? Expect that this chart will get worse in the future. Right now, for simplicity's sake, let's say there are four major types of nicotinic receptors. Three of them are expressed by neurons. One type is expressed by muscles. Let's start with the simple one, muscles. Okay, the neuromuscular junction receptors. We know their typical configuration. I don't expect you to memorize that. They are cholinergic receptors. So ACH is a potent agonist for them. What was the analog of ACH that didn't break down?
Carbachol.
And there's many others, but carbachol was the one worth learning. Are these muscarinic or nicotinic receptors? Nicotinic. So not surprising. Nicotine is an agonist for them. Muscarin is not. There's another drug that's used clinically. You want to activate these receptors called epibatidine. How many of you have ever gone in a hospital and see patients smoking under direct order of the doctor? Almost never. So instead, they typically give people epibatidine if they want to activate those receptors. It works on the muscle. In fact, all of those so far act on all the types of receptors. If you want something specifically just to activate the neuromuscular receptors, and then look at a particular South American frog. They pick up anatoxin. Anatoxin. That will activate just the neuromuscular receptors. Again, if they're in a hospital, probably not a good supply of frogs. So instead, a methonium compound, succinylmethonium. And by now, it probably really sucks that you had to worm so many drugs. sucks a methonium. All right, that's the simple one, the neuromuscular receptor. Quite a list, right? Thankfully, a big chunk of that list applies to everything else, too. Acetylcholine applies to all the neuronal receptors. So does carbachol, so does nicotine, so does epibatatine. Okay? Then we have an agonist that only activates the neuronal receptors, not the neuromuscular ones. Aricolide. You give that, it's not going to touch the muscles, just the brain, just the ganglia. All right, now we have to divide between the brain and the ganglia, the central nervous system and the rest of the nervous system. We've already eliminated the part that only communicates with muscles. Now let's further subdivide it. We've got the communication between the central nervous system and autonomic ganglia. And then we've got two more types that are contained within the central nervous system, especially within the brain. So let's look at the ganglia first. Ganglia are affected by aricolide. It affects all these neuronal types. They're not affected by antitoxin. Guess what? The central nervous system is affected by antitoxin, just like the neuromuscular junction was. The good thing about licking frogs, if there is any good thing, a peptide's big enough it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. So you'd have to inject the frog slime into your brain to have an effect on the nervous system. If anybody ever removes your skull and starts rubbing frogs on your head, you probably have worse problems than worrying about the effects of antitoxin. If you want something just to activate the ganglionic receptors, something like DMPP, and again, this is why we use abbreviations, DMPP. Doesn't affect the other types of nicotinic receptors. I'm hoping nobody was taking a picture of that. Then we have the two types that are found inside the central nervous system. And they're named in a very arcane fashion, the way that we first discovered them back in the 1980s. Whether they're sensitive to bungarotoxin or they're insensitive to bungarotoxin. Bungarotoxin comes from certain families of snakes, cobras, for instance. How many of you have ever had a cobra bite you in the brain? See, again, if somebody had, they wouldn't answer that question. Doesn't seem the best nomenclature to use. It turns out the ones that are sensitive to that snake venom are the alpha 7 receptors. And given that it's 2011, that's the better nomenclature to learn now. The alpha 7s versus the others that are not sensitive to the snake venom. And you don't have to worry about being bitten in the brain by a cobra. It's not all that funny.
Yes, it is. Yeah, the mental image is the problem.
So, the alpha 7s are activated by substances like nicotine. Again, all of these are activated by nicotine. But they're also activated by certain other plant-sourced alkaloids. In this particular case, it would be good to learn the one that's used experimentally, anabasine. Anabasine. That's as opposed to the non-alpha-7 receptors, which are activated by a compound that comes from a different group of plants, the alkaloid lobelin. Any of you that have ever studied Aboriginal tribes in North America may have read about their use of the plant that is the source of lobelin. Texas lingo, we would call it Indian tobacco. I don't think any of the tribes ever referred to it in that fashion. But you can smoke that without the nicotinic addictive properties that tobacco has. It activates the non-alpha-7 receptors in the nervous system. Pardon? Sure, it does the same things to the non-alpha-7 receptors in the nervous system. But it doesn't seem to be addictive. The alpha-7s are the ones that seem to have that addictive property. Okay. So you could distinguish them by those two drugs. Anabasine will stimulate the alpha-7s. Lobelin will not. It will stimulate the non-alpha-7 central nervous system receptors. Still a complicated looking chart, but remember, all of these were for everything. Then we had some specialized drugs at the bottom to help you keep track of those four different types of receptors. So which one would be affected if you were bitten in the brain by a cobra? The alpha sevens, okay? So if you were, you'd want an antagonist, perhaps, right? No, it turns out cobra venom is an antagonist. So if you were ever bitten in the brain by a cobra, you'd like to have this drug available. If you didn't have that drug, what should you do? Smoke a lot of packs of cigarettes. Assuming you weren't already dead. It wouldn't help. You probably need a lot of frogs because the cobra venom is really intensely concentrated. And the frog, much smaller concentration. I doubt you could probably smoke enough cigarettes to do it either, though. You might could do it with anabasine, though. You could probably get the concentration high enough. Don't volunteer for that experiment if somebody decides to run it. Okay? All right, that was agonists. We're going to talk for a moment about antagonists. So first I'm going to start with the simple side of antagonists. We've mentioned a couple of different kinds of synapses outside the central nervous system. The synapses in ganglia, where the premotor neurons contact either the sympathetic ganglia, which are far away from their targets, close to the spinal cord or the brainstem, or the parasympathetic ganglia, which are close to their target, far away from the central nervous system. In both cases, these are cholinergic neurons coming out from the central nervous system onto neurons in the ganglia. So which of these ganglionic neurons are cholinergic? Parasympathetic or sympathetic? These are the cholinergic neurons. Their neuromuscular transmitter is also acetylcholine. These are not. What are these? These are adrenergic neurons. They release norepinephrine. But the receptors in the ganglia for both are nicotinic receptors. They get acetylcholine from the central nervous system. It causes those motor neurons to fire. Everybody clear on that? What's the transmitter from the central nervous system to the autonomic ganglia? It's acetylcholine for both branches. From the central nervous system to the ganglion. In both cases, sympathetic and parasympathetic, from spinal cord or brainstem to the ganglion is ACH. onto nicotinic receptors. From the ganglion, the neurons that live there are motor neurons. It's different. Okay. Parasympathetic is primarily what transmitter? Acetylcholine. Sympathetic, primary transmitter? Norepinephrine. Adrenergic versus cholinergic. Okay. But both of them get their signal from the nervous system via acetylcholine. What's the signal from the nervous system to muscles at the neuromuscular junction? Except for the sympathetic nervous system, what's the signal? Acetylcholine. Not just for the autonomic, but for the skeletal muscle system as well. Onto nicotinic receptors. So much of our neuromuscular communication is carried by acetylcholine. Turns out the drugs have different impacts on synapses here versus synapses here at the target. And here's one of the few cases where the structure of the drug actually makes sense to us in terms of its functional difference. This is one of the very few cases where it makes good sense. This is a drug called hexamethonium. Hexamethonium. What does hex mean in the Latin language? Six. How many carbohydrates do you see in this center chain? Six. It's named for that central chain. If I told you there's also a drug called decamethonium, how many would it have in that chain? 10. You could have duomethonium, quadromethonium, octomethonium. You could make a drug with 100 carbohydrates in there. It'd probably fold all up on itself. But depending on how many carbohydrate groups are in that middle, it will have more effect at one or another of these two types of synapses. Hexamethonium, the shorter one, it only has six in the middle, is effective at these autonomic ganglia. As an antagonist, it blocks binding of acetylcholine to those receptors there. How many molecules of hexamethonium would it take to block an acetylcholine receptor? One, two? That's a trick question. It would really only take one. Because as long as you block either one of those acetylcholine binding sites, you've rendered the receptor inoperable. If you block both, it would be even better, but you don't have to block both. So that is sort of a trick question. Okay. What was this one called with 10? Decamethonium. Decamethonium is much more effective at the neuromuscular junction. Hardly touches the ganglionic nicotinic receptors. So if you looked at their potency, it's very differential based on the length of that central carbohydrate chain. Longer ones are more effective at the neuromuscular junction. We'll see lots of examples where you'll have a molecule that's really tiny and one that is incredibly large and completely structurally unrelated, and they'll both bind to the same site. So it's hardly ever that it makes this much sense. Yes?
On a previous slide, the substantive molecule was specific to the neuromuscular junction as an agonist. So would that related to
HECFA and HECFA? As an agonist, this is antagonist properties. What would succinomethonium be?
Well, since it's
So in Latin, what does succa mean? Any Latin experts out there?
It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything? Well, it probably does, but no. It's used here to mean 17. It's a corruption of Latin, I believe.
Okay, yeah.
So succa methodium would be way out here, and it's an agonist at the neuromuscular junction instead of an antagonist. Septamethonium would be somewhere in between the hexa and the desa. But agonist properties don't necessarily predict antagonist either, unfortunately. But it's a good question. All right. This looks terrible. Before you panic, you already know there's four different types of receptors. You already know this 2 slides ago. You already know these two drugs. Hexamethonium, chicamethonium. We've already talked about snakes a little bit. So let's finish filling the chart in. Again, logically. Let's start with the simple one, the neuromuscular junction. There are drugs that work there that don't work elsewhere. As antagonists, ones that are very commonly used in an OR, relatives of what in the loose nomenclature we call curare. You go in the OR and call it curare, they'll slap you. And I'd rather you say something like tubocurarine. But all the drugs in that category have some root related to curare. They'll never use curare in the OR because that's a very crude plant extract. It's got lots of other things in it too. But most people, when they talk about it, don't distinguish that. These days, you're more commonly going to see a synthetic drug used, like succinylcholine. To block the neuromuscular junction. Then we had the three different neuronal type of nicotinic receptors. We had the one in the ganglia, and it's sensitive to a different type of snake venom, kappa bungarotoxin. And we've already talked about the fact that it's good to know the Greek alphabet and Roman numerals and all that sort of thing for pharmacology. In the OR, if you want to prevent somebody's heart from racing or something of that sort, you'd use a drug like trimethoprim. When you get into the central nervous system, remember the alpha-7 receptors were sensitive to the cobra venom, alpha-bungarotoxin, and the non-alpha-7s were not. Well, it turns out we have an antagonist that will block those, called coronardine. Or if you're a big Mexican beer drinker, you could say it's coronaridine. Never heard it pronounced that way except in class, though. These drugs down in this category, notice there's not any for the central nervous system, technically are antagonists. Trimethoprim and succinylcholine. Physiologically, they're actually agonists. They're such potent agonists that they depolarize the cell so strongly, and they have such high affinity for the receptor, they stay bound to the receptor. So you fire the cell one time, and it stays depolarized. Do neurons normally work that way? No, they fire and they go back to rest and they're ready to fire again. So we put those into a special category that we call depolarizing blockers. The net effect is that they are antagonists. And they bind to the agonist binding site to do it. But they act by a special mechanism. By activating it so strongly and staying bound, you can't use the receptor again until they come unbound. So they're effective as antagonists. Have you ever seen this drug before?
Yes.
PCP. What did we talk about it before? In what context? It was a dissociative anesthetic. Where did it bind? What's called the PCP site on the NMDA receptor. Where was that located?
Inside the channel.
Inside the ion channel. Was this a use-dependent drug for NMDA receptors? The ion channel had to be open or it couldn't get to that site. Since it's on this chart, is PCP a very selective drug?
No.
Very specific drug? No. Turns out there will be lots of other charts that PCP will show up on. PCP has a wide range of effects. It's a really sloppy drug. It might make you really sloppy too. Lots of others that share common properties. Don't expect them to memorize any others. A couple other drugs that's worth your time to learn. One is a drug that's most often prescribed as an antidepressant. Bupropion or Wellbutrin. If you turn this over, it looks like it has a smiley face painted on it.
Well, that's why they prescribe it for smoking. They have a different name for it.
Right. They Wellbutrin on it and the smile. And they put the dose that looks like eyeballs. If you turn it upside down, it looks like the smiley face. Maybe that produces a placebo effect on people that are depressed.
What if you buy the generic?
Well, then I guess you don't get it. Or maybe they have to print it on special. Yeah.
Is it like Wellbutrin that makes you have these crazy nightmares, dreams?
Some people. None of them have a consistent effect. There's a significant portion of people that smoke, though, that are actually helped in stopping smoking. If they're treated with Wellbutrin. Wellbutrin binds to alpha-7 receptors and blocks them. We don't know that's the primary mode of action, though. Could be people are depressed when they try to stop smoking, and they need the antidepressant effect. It could be both. It's hard to separate the two from one another. To really separate it, we need a better alpha-7 antagonist than cobra venom. Not many people are going to volunteer to be bitten in the brain by a cobra to stop smoking. Again, it's hard to control the dose there as well. One more category of drugs and we're done with antagonists. Suicide antagonists. TMA. There's others, but TMA is the one that's most commonly used. What's a suicide antagonist? Binds to the receptor with a binding coefficient. The KD is longer than the life cycle of the protein. So it essentially takes that receptor protein out of the physiological availability. All right, so not quite as complicated a diagram as it looks at first. If you remember the four different types. Which one's sensitive to the cobra venom? The alpha-7s. And are those sodium channels? That's the weird ones, the calcium channels. Which one seems to play a major role in smoking? Alpha 7 for the addictive properties, but all of the above for all the other effects of nicotine. At one last review, because again, you've got an exam coming up. You should be putting all the information together that you've had so far. When we look at a typical synapse, what kind of synapse is this? Neuromuscular junction. We could draw a synapse to the central nervous system and do the same sort of things. We know drugs that can impact various stages in neurotransmission. So say the action potential is coming down the axon. Are there any drugs that could prevent that? Drugs that block sodium channels, like TTX or local anesthetics. Is there anything that could prevent neurotransmitter release? We talk about things like Botox, that can interfere with the proteins, the snares, cause release. How about calcium channel blockers and things of that sort? Does that have an effect? Okay. And then how about postsynaptically? In the case of the neuromuscular junction, the nicotinic receptor. We talked about different kinds of substances that affect that. Some of them more specific, some of them like PCP, not very specific at all. And then, of course, in the postsynaptic cell, there's other things that we could impact. So when you think of neurotransmission, don't just think of the receptors here. Think of everything that goes into that neurotransmission. Because we know many, many more pieces of the puzzle than just the postsynaptic receptors. Or at least I hope you do by now. And we'll find out in a week from today. Right?
Let us get?
No.
Promise.
No, that's a hope and an expectation. Okay? That's it for today.